We are, as you can see, in the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation. As I reviewed last week's class, I see that indeed we did get pretty much to the end of chapter 17. I'm not going to bother to spend time reviewing that, except what I want to do is go through the charts that we've got in here that have to do with the introduction to chapter 18. Now, in the introduction to chapter 18, we do have on the slides that are here, there's like, I believe, 11 slides. It has to do with where we are now and how we got here and how the book of Revelation is divided up. So if we look at this, we see that the book of Revelation essentially is divided up into two parts. And I just flip back and forth between these two slides here once. The struggle on earth as chapters 1 through 11, and then Christ and the dragon in conflict, chapters 12 through 22. As we've looked at that, we see when we're looking at the struggle on earth, we see that there's a lot that's going on in various places, but we also see that there's, in parts of it, there's also the struggle in heaven. And that comes down to earth. But as we look at the first part, the first chapter, of course, we have the introduction of John's vision and everything that goes on there. Then, of course, as we know, in the second and third chapters, we have the letters to the seven churches of Asia. We have a tendency to say seven churches of Asia Minor, but that's not a biblical term. It just says Asia. So it is to us Asia Minor because we have a broader understanding of the term Asia. So there are those, and of course, when we look at the seven churches of Asia, what was our conclusion as to whether or not that was all the churches of Asia or just representative?
Just representative, not all of them.
Okay. What would we say that they're representative of? Go ahead, Randy.
Representative of all the churches.
Yeah, a representative of all the churches of the world and sort of the different positions you might say that they might be in or the different circumstances they might be in. So we had what? Out of the seven churches, we had two that didn't have any condemnation to them, right? That doesn't mean that they were perfect, but it did mean that they were churches that were doing things that were right to the greatest extent. And there were other churches that had things that were wrong with them that they were told that they needed to correct. But if we look at what we might call quote unquote the worst church, which one would we choose?
Laodicea,
most likely. Okay, because he just gets at them from verse 1 all the way through the end, and Laodicea is chastised for being what kind of a church?
Lukewarm.
And I think that's something that we need to look at and that we need to think about when we think about the kind of people that we are, the kind of church that we have, as to whether or not we're lukewarm or if we're hot or cold. You know, that's something that we need to consider. So that's good. And you'll remember way back in the beginning of this, you know, this is, I believe, on Revelation. I believe this is class number 68, something like that. So way back in classes number, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 or something, I went through all the seven churches geographically, and we took a little aerial tour of where those churches are and all that. And you can see that they sort of line up in a rough circle in the area of Asia, starting with Ephesus and going north and around to the east and back around, ending up with Laodicea and coming back to Ephesus. So it was interesting, in my opinion, to look at the churches and where they were to get some idea of what we're looking at. I think one of the things that helped me and perhaps Linda most in our visualization of things that had to do with the Bible was being able to go to what they call the Bible lands. And, you know, the very idea of standing up on the podium in Corinth where Paul would have stood to talk to the people in the agora, in the marketplace, and then be able to turn around and see that big hill behind you with the temple on top where all the where all the idol worship went on. It just gives you a deeper perspective of what's going on. So that's why I like to go through that as Eve called it my travel log. Yeah, to go through these things with Google Earth. All right. As we left chapters 2 and 3, we realize in chapters 4 and 5 that the writer here is telling us that God is in control. So in chapters 4 and 5. And then in chapters 6 through 11, we have the opening of the seven seals. And so it's interesting to note that throughout that we open a seal or two or three, and then we have a pause, as Mickey mentions, an interlude. And so many times for an entire chapter that talks about something that has to do with the fact that this has been opened, but things that are going to be coming up, as it were. Right, as we then go to the second section of the book of Revelation, in chapters 12 through 22, we have this title with a deeper spiritual meaning, we realize that here on the struggle on earth in the first 11 chapters, a lot of it has to do with our physical existence, though the fact of the matter is that if we looked at chapters 2 and 3, we understand that there's a lot of spiritual concerns that need to be addressed there. But there are many physical things, but when we get to the second half of the book of Revelation, then we're, as Mickey says, delving into a deeper spiritual meaning. And so we have a war described in chapters 12 through 14, and I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, and not having to specifically look this up, we were talking about war in heaven. We're not talking about war on earth at this time. But later on, that comes down to earth. And then, of course, in chapters 15 and 16, we have the bowls of wrath, which as we discussed, were sort of parallel to the seven seals. So you had seven seals, you had seven bowls of wrath. A lot of them were similar, but there were nuances that had to do with the deeper, as he puts, deeper spiritual meaning here, that were there because of that. And now as we look in the third section here, we talk about fall of Babylon, the harlot, in chapters 17 and 18. And as Mickey mentioned a week or so ago, the study is going to have a tendency to speed up now, and we see that we've gotten through the parts that go into great detail, and now when we look at D and E on here, we talk about the victory of God's people and warnings about the book. When we think about that, we realize that these are going pretty quickly. These are going to go pretty quickly, I think. So I estimate we'll probably only have another 4 or 5 years to finish, you know, doing the last few chapters of this book. So anyway, chapters 17 and 18 sort of go together and talk about the fall of Babylon called the harlot. And then as we get onto that, then after we get through with that, we see that in chapter 19, it immediately goes into the victory of God's people and so on, as that is. So as we look specifically into the introduction of chapter 18 and look at the outline of chapter 18, we talk about the fall of Babylon, the harlot. And so we have another, as it says, why don't we do this? Well, there's 24 verses. That's a pretty long one. Randy, would you like to read the first, 3 verses of chapter 18? Bruce, just hang on, Bruce.
I was just going to mention, that there are other two falls that happened before the fall of Babylon. So we're looking at Syria and also Persia, whatever that was.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they're not mentioned, so now we see the fall of Babylon, which helps us understand, Daniel's.
Oh, I have a bit to discuss about that. Hopefully at the end of the class here, assuming we don't run out of time, that has to do with Babylon, physically that has to do with Babylon. Let's see. Well, you willing to go through 8 verses? I notice that he's got here verses 1-8, the announcement of from heaven of her fall.
Sure.
Do you do that, please? Thank you.
Revelation 18, 1-8. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place of demons, and a prison of every unclean spirit, and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality." I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds. In the cup which she has mixed, mix twice as much for her. To the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, 'I sit as a queen and am not a widow, and will never see mourning.' For this reason, in one day her plagues will come, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire. And the Lord God who judges her is strong."
All right. An introduction, an announcement from heaven. We see that it starts off with another angel coming down out of heaven. And then in verse 4, he says, "I heard another voice from heaven." So we have two announcements here from heaven about the fall of Babylon. And we'll get into that as we go on. I'm tempted right now to go into my discussion about Babylon, but I think we'll wait on that. So see if I can actually get through the introduction. But then as we continue to read through chapter 18, we see that there's a whole list of those people that are mourning the fall of Babylon the Great, the harlot. And we see that they are essentially condemned with her because, as we see in the announcement here, that they participated in the adultery with her. And, of course, once again, we're talking about spiritual manifestations here. And then we see also, though, that even though there's a lot of mourning that goes on, there's rejoicing of her fall that comes in verse 20. And that, of course, I believe, as I recall, is the saints, right? "Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye saints, and ye apostles, and ye prophets, for God hath judged your judgment on her." So there is rejoicing, but not of those people that we've spoken up in verses 9 through 19. And then finally, it discusses her fall in verses 21 through 24 at the end of the chapter. So then we go to the outline of verses 1 through 8, the specific outline of that. And so we see that there's an angel there with great authority, verses 1 through 3. I think... Randy, would you read verse 1 again, please?
"After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory."
All right, that's almost exactly what the American Standard says. So he says, this is an angel with great authority. So you might say an important personage. Certainly he had the authority from God to say the things that he had to say. He talks about Babylon being fallen, what it's become, and the reason for her fall. And then, as we mentioned in verses 4-8, there's another voice that comes from heaven that tells God's people to get out, and that Babylon will receive her just reward. And then, as we go on to the second part of this, those that mourn her fall. Remember, there were 4 parts that we looked at. Those who mourn her fall. Those are the kings of the earth. They're the merchants. They're the shipmasters, as one of the terms says, the mariners. Those are the ones that mourn her fall. And then in the third section, then when her fall causes rejoicing in verse 20, we see that that's in heaven, and that we see it's among those that are avenged by the fall of Babylon. And then in the fourth section there, the finality of the fall in verses 21 through 24, that's of course, the angel throws this big stone into the sea, just as essentially an example. that's all it's really saying. In verse 21, it says, a strong angel took up a stone as it were a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, thus with a mighty fall shall Babylon, the great city, be cast down and shall be found no more at all. And so all the angel is showing is that just like this stone went into the ocean and went away, so Babylon will do the same thing. Once again, I'll emphasize this is spiritual Babylon, and we'll discuss that. verses 22 through 23, all activity will cease in her, and the reason for that is because she'd slain the prophets and the saints. So interesting to note that she had slain the prophets and the saints. And then as his final wrap up here, he's got a discussion about sin and a nation and how it responds to that. And so looking at Proverbs, the 14th chapter and verse 34, we understand that righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And I think that's the comparison that's being made here. When we look at the book of Revelation, we see that there's righteousness that exalts the proper people, you might say, but that sin is a reproach. And we see that enumerated here just right and left in chapter 17 and 18 about sin being a reproach. if you want to look at a denominational commentator, and his William Barclay in his commentary on Revelation says this is the fate of a city that built a civilization without God. Of course, they built their civilization with many gods, but not Jehovah God. You'll remember that there was a related discussion in the book of Acts when Paul was in a big city there. What did he say about Athens? He said, I see that you're a very religious people. Or as I go along, I see these idols all over the place. And I see one idol to the unknown God. He said, this God I set forward to you. No indication that Rome even had anything like that, or as we say, spiritual Babylon, had a temple, idol to the unknown God that we could use as a stepping stone to say, well, now I can teach you about the real God. And then Ray Summers in his book, Worthy as the Lamb, says, nothing can be economically good that is morally bad. And so I'm not sure that I want to say that that's a great absolute truth. I see a lot of morally bad places that are economically good. One might look at, the country we live in, that is morally reprobate to a large extent, but the economy is extremely good, much better than most economies in the rest of the world. Randy?
I don't agree with that statement.
Which one? The one I made or the one that he made?
The bottom.
Okay, yeah.
I think the economically good is morally bad.
Yeah.
Look at Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
One city just proves that state.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Yeah, they're definitely economically good. And they've got a sound church there, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's worth thinking about. So anyway, there's a couple of interesting points. Well, what I wanted to do is that... We've had a lot of discussion in these two chapters and actually throughout the book of Revelation about Babylon. And that's interesting because we realize that if we take the early date, this was written in about 70 AD. If we take the late date, it was written about 96 AD. But be that as it may, it was still in the first century, is that right? First, 0 to 100 would be first century. It's still written in the first century AD. So if we look at that, we then wonder, there's a lot of discussion here about Babylon. And we see that we've discussed back and forth people that are saying, well, this is what Babylon was like, and Nebuchadnezzar this, and Darius that, and you know, all this sort of stuff. And you go, no, wait a minute. We're talking about either 70 or 96 AD here. What was the state of physical Babylon at that time? And so let's look at that, because there's, I think, too many people that think that we're talking about a physical Babylon here and are not talking about the kingdom of Rome, or the Roman Empire, you might say. I did some looking on, of course, the most trustworthy source of all, Wikipedia, right? So, there's some interesting observations to be made regarding the city of Babylon, and so, as we know, Babylon was the capital of the ancient Babylonian Empire, which itself refers actually to either of two separate entities in the Mesopotamian area in antiquity. There are two empires that achieved dominance, one between the 19th and 15th centuries BC, and again between the 7th and 6th centuries BC. The one that we generally are concerned about when we're looking at Old Testament things and also the book of Revelation is that empire, which was between the 7th and 6th centuries BC. But there was an empire in the 19th to 15th. You got 19, 18, 17, 16, 15. It's like 600 years, right? Well, let me count them, right? 500 years. So I didn't have my calculator. So even though I have fingers, five. Or was that a hand? Six.
When you're talking about the first one, though, it was not a world empire, was it?
Not really, no. It was more locally dominant.
Yeah.
I don't think it even went down into Israel or over into India like it did before.
Yeah, I just mean in the account that we find in Daniel 2 of the empires, he was talking about a world, each one of those was a world empire.
Yeah. Well, I think he was talking about Nebuchadnezzar at that time, right?
Right.
And he was definitely part of the what's called the Neo-Babylonian Empire, which is the second one that I mentioned.
Because he had conquered the first one, which was Assyria.
Yes, Assyria actually, and others, conquered the original Babylonian Empire, and they became the world empire. And then Nebuchadnezzar and his folks conquered that Assyrian Empire, and then they in turn were conquered by, but yes, the statue of Daniel starts with Nebuchadnezzar and works on down. Jonathan, did you have your hand up? Or? No, okay. that's the city, of course, as we know, was built along both banks of the Euphrates River. They put up steep embankments on either side because it was much like, I think, the Nile River in that it has seasonal flooding. So they put dikes up or whatever to keep it from damaging the city. but as you'll recall, the discussion of the city of Babylon indicated that the river flowed through the city. So they built a city like on both sides of the river. I assume they had bridges over it or something like that. And supposedly they had an iron gate under the water level where the water entered the city so people couldn't just swim into the city and, you know, do things with their battleships and stuff like that. So, interestingly enough, it says that the earliest known mention of Babylon as a small town appears on a clay tablet from the reign of Sargon of Akkad and his reign was from 2334 to 2279 BC. That's, if I figured it right, that's like 80 years, quite a long time. So he's of course of the Akkadian Empire. so as a small town, this Babylon was in existence even back in the 2300s BC. Did I say 80? But BC. Anyway. The current site is just south of present day Baghdad, which is in the country of
Iraq,
yes. And then this kind of sums up one of the articles. The last known record of habitation of the town dates from the 10th century AD when it was referred to as the small village of Babel. Now, as we look a little more closely at this, the first Babylonian dynasty in the 19th century rose, and it was a small independent city-state, much like you might recall Greece was like that. They had a bunch of city-states. They weren't, for the longest time, they weren't really unified. They were just all independents. And then you'll remember King Hammurabi, who we credit with establishing one of the first codified rules of law, which many times is referred to still as principles of law. He was an Amorite king, and he founded the old Babylonian Empire in the 18th century BC. But he was the one to build Babylon up into a major city. He declared himself its king. Southern Mesopotamia then became known as Babylonia, and Babylon then eclipsed Nippur as the region's holy city. So apparently this little town before had been their holy city where sacrifices to their gods and stuff were made, and Babylon became the one. But after Hammurabi died, his sons spent the empire of Babylon then spent a long period of time under Assyrian, Kassite, and Elamite domination. The Assyrians, of course, destroyed it and then rebuilt it. After they had done that, Babylon became the capital of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, after the Assyrians go away, which was, as they say here, a Neo-Assyrian successor state. In other words, they're the people that defeated the Assyrians. So they could have said that more simply. Interestingly enough, this capital, Babylon being the capital of the short-lived Neo-Babylonian Empire, lasted from about 609 to 539 BC. Interestingly enough, if you add those numbers up, it comes out to 70 years. Now, I think that's probably just a coinkydink, but still, there's a 70-year thing going on here, and it may very well be that that's what we're talking about, because we started with Nebuchadnezzar, we ended up with Darius, and we realized that the Neo-Babylonian Empire ended with Darius's capture of the city, to where the Persians then took over. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, of course, they were one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. After the fall of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, the city came under the rule of the Achaemenid, the Seleucid, the Parthian, the Romans, and the Sassanid empires. So we see here that when we talk about the Achaemenid and the Seleucid, we're talking about as we go down the statue of Daniel, we see that we're talking about Babylon, then we're talking about the Medo-Persians, then we're talking about the Greeks, and then we're talking about the Romans. So we see that indeed history bears that out. It was estimated that Babylon was the largest city in the world around 1700, 1670 BC. And again, around 612 to around 320 BC. So in those, that's the two times that the empire of Babylon was great. They suppose that it was perhaps the first city to reach a population of about 200,000. Estimates for the maximum extent of area of the city itself go to about 2,200 acres. It's currently about, the site now is about 85 kilometers, 53 miles south of Baghdad. It comprises a large tell of broken mud brick buildings and debris. As far as the Persian conquest goes, so we've been talking about Nebuchadnezzar and his folks and the Neo-Babylonian Empire. But in 539 BC, that empire fell, of course, to Cyrus the Great, king of Persia. Yeah, Darius came after that. Though Babylon's walls were considered impenetrable, what did Cyrus do? What did Cyrus do to gain entrance to the city, Jonathan?
He dammed up the river and marched up the relatively dry river.
Yeah. Yeah, so he diverted the river upstream, which meant that all of a sudden you could essentially walk into the city. All you had to do was get through that iron gate, which after years of rusting underwater probably wasn't hard to do. That's the common theory, anyway, as to actually what happened. is that they essentially just walked into the city. There's a comment here about, since the walls were considered impenetrable, the only way into the city was through one of its many gates or through the Euphrates River. Metal grates were installed underwater, allowing the river to flow through the city walls while preventing intrusion. The Persians devised a plan to enter the city via the river during a Babylonian national feast. Cyrus's troops upstream diverted the Euphrates River, allowing Cyrus's soldiers to enter the city through the lowered water level. And then the Persian army conquered the outlying areas of the city there, while the majority of the Babylonians were still celebrating at the city center. They were unaware of the breach. Under Cyrus and then the Persian king Darius I, who we've talked about before, Babylon became the capital city of the ninth satrapy. In other words, it was a portion of the Persian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire. As well, and was also became a center of learning and scientific advancement. While the Achaemenids were in power, the ancient Babylonian arts of astronomy and mathematics were revitalized, and Babylonian scholars completed maps of constellations. So, it's interesting to think that even way back there in the like 6th and 7th century BC, that people were actually doing math and stuff like that. Didn't have calculators. But the city became just simply an administrative center or capital for the Persian Empire. It remained prominent for over 200 years after that. The Persian kings attempted to maintain the religious ceremonies of the god they called Marduk, who was an important god, but by the reign of Darius III, over taxation, strain of numerous wars led to deterioration of Babylon's main shrines and canals and the destabilization of the surrounding region. So under the Persian Empire, even though Babylon was a sort of an important religious center, they got into internal conflicts and problems with finances and such alike as that. So there are a lot of attempts at rebellion. And then Nebuchadnezzar III and Nebuchadnezzar IV, and in 582 BC, a couple of people whose names I'm not going to try and pronounce right now, they regained a certain amount of independence. The revolts, however, were quickly repressed, and Babylon remained under Persian rule for 2 centuries until Alexander the Great's entry in 331 BC. So, you look at Babylon, you say, well, if it wasn't for bad luck, they wouldn't have any luck at all. They just... nobody really likes them. So they started off real strong way back in the 19th century, and then they got conquered by Assyria. And then they managed to strengthen themselves and conquer Assyria, and then they got conquered by Cyrus and then Darius and then the Greeks and then later on the Romans, and it's just not working out well for them at all. So, and then in the Hellenistic period. So in October of 331 B.C., Darius III, who was the last of the Achaemenid kings of Persia, was defeated by the forces of Alexander at the Battle of Gaugamela. That's important to remember, so it'll be on the test. 331 BC, over 300 years before the birth of Christ, Darius III lost the empire to Alexander. All right, under Alexander... Babylon was a center of learning and commerce once again, but following Alexander's death in 323 BC, apparently in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar himself, his empire was divided among his generals, and decades of fighting soon began. As they say here, the constant turmoil virtually emptied the city of Babylon. A tablet dated 275 BC states that the inhabitants of Babylon were transported to Seleucia, where a palace and temple, the Saglia, were built. With this deportation, Babylon became insignificant as a city, although more than a century later, sacrifices were still performed in its old sanctuary. What I wanted us to see here is that when we're talking in the book of Revelation about Babylon, we cannot possibly be talking about the physical city of Babylon. There's just so many inconsistencies in that, and there are so many things that show us we're talking about the Roman Empire here, that we see that this is a representation. What was the it's a figure of what really is. And people have hypothesized, supposed, or whatever, that one of the reasons that God caused this book to be written in these figures and symbols and signs was so that the people that were reading this book would not be, instantly crushed by the Roman government. Because unless you read through it carefully, you're not going to understand that Babylon is talking about the Roman Empire. You're going to think, well, they're talking about Babylon. But of course, when you go through the 18th chapter, and I believe the 19th chapter also, you see a lot of indications that this can't be talking about Babylon because a lot of the references have to do with seafarers and mariners and people bringing their ships in and all that sort of stuff. You go, Babylon was like hundreds of miles inland, maybe thousands for all I know. I mean, it's that far on the map. So it's a long way from any kind of real water as far as the Mediterranean goes to that. Now, it isn't too far from the Gulf of whatever it is down there to the south where the Tigris and Euphrates flow into. But, Randy?
I was just going to say it was very much like a secret code. God's people knew what it meant.
Yes, exactly.
If you weren't God's people, you had no clue what it meant.
Yes. And I think that's exactly it. God's people knew what was being talked about here. And I think they, as they were reading through this, they had discussions about that, of course. Like we are, exactly. That's where we're having Bible classes. So, and, of course, we need to understand that there were a certain amount of spiritual gifts still in existence at the time that this book was written. And so there could have been people there that were explaining this in much more detail in the local assemblies of the Lord's church at that time. But there are so many references to the fact that the persecution that we're talking about has to do with the saints and the apostles and the prophets. That what has that got to do with the Babylonians as far as, you know, talking about Nebuchadnezzar and things like that? It doesn't. There were no saints. And apostles. There were prophets, yeah, but we don't see any particular persecution of prophets happening during the Babylonian Empire. We see that there was a general persecution of the Jews and by the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Greeks and the Romans and all that sort of stuff. the thing is that it doesn't match up. You say, oh, we're talking about the Babylonian Empire. No, we're not. Nothing in here is talking about the Babylonian Empire. It's all talking about the Roman Empire. It's interesting to note as we get into the discussion about the harlot on the beast and all of that sort of stuff. And I think, was it in 17 where they already talked about that? In verse 16 of chapter 17, it talks about even though that she's riding on this beast, the ten horns and the beast itself hated her. Oh, so they couldn't even make up their minds, you know, type thing. So it's not a great relationship. The fact of the matter is that there's so much play on words going here, and so many thoughts about. I think as Randy mentioned there. Essentially a code that Christians would understand, but that the people in authority who had absolutely no idea what a single God would do anyway wouldn't have a clue what this was about. And apparently they didn't. Because even when it came down to the persecution of Christians, I don't recall anything being said about, well, the Christians are being persecuted because this horrible book that they have that talks about the destruction of the Roman Empire. I go, no, I don't remember anybody saying anything about that. Bruce?
Yeah, just you mentioned also it talks about the woman and the dragon in chapter 12 as well.
Oh, yeah, chapter 12 also. Yeah, right. Yes, Randy?
Historical interest, and then there's a connection. The first time, at least that I know of, that Babylon is referenced is Babel. You know, the city of Babel.
Babel, yeah.
which we see in Genesis 11, is where they try to build a tower that was raised to heaven, and God confused their languages.
Yes.
So we see that that's the beginning of multiple languages, is the Tower of Babel. But Babel is mentioned earlier. Noah's great-grandson, Nimrod, was the one who founded it. It says, this is Genesis 10:10. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, and the land of Shinar, and from the land he went forth to Assyria and built Nineveh, and Rehoboth, Ur, and Calah, and a few others. Anyway, it's just interesting to note that Nimrod was, you know, the founder of both the capital of Assyria and the capital of Babylon.
Oh yeah, okay.
They were just cities back then, but it says his kingdom began there, so that is interesting, as well as in 2 Kings 17. So what's happening in 2 Kings 17, as the remnant is leaving Babylon and coming back into
Israel.
Canaan.
Yeah.
They're coming back in, and it's pointed out there, I had the verse just a second ago. Verse 20, this is 2 Kings 17, 24. The king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and Kutha, and from Abba, and from Hamath, and Sabarthium, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, and settled them in the cities of Samaria in the place of the sons of Israel. So they possessed Samaria and lived in its cities. So this is when they brought in people from, you know, the Syrian Empire, mixed all of their captives together to keep them from organizing and overthrowing the government.
Yes.
And, of course, they mixed them in with several of the, you know, the remaining Jews that were still in the land. And that's where verse 28 says, that's when the Lord sent lions among them and killed some of them. And they said, well, you know, we have to make friends with the God of this land.
Right.
And so they sent for a priest, and they sent the priest who had no clue what they were teaching. You're familiar with the story. But verse 29 says, every nation still made gods of its own and put them in the houses of the high places which the people of Samaria had made, and every nation in their cities in which they lived. Verse 33, they feared the Lord and served their own gods according to the custom of the nations among whom they had been carried away into exile. So the application really that I was getting at was that Babylon, or Babel, is always symbolic of godlessness and idolatry.
It's true.
It always, it never was not. It was always a symbol of idolatry, and that's why when he talks about the great harlot, well, that's what idolatry is. Mm-hmm. Idolatry is bowing before somebody who didn't make you.
Mm-hmm.
You made it.
No,
it didn't make you. You made it.
Right.
And then bowed down and worshipped it. And that's harlotry. That's adultery. That's spiritual adultery, because there's only one God. And he made us. We don't make God. God makes us.
Right.
It's much like the one where, you know, the guy chops down the tree and, you know, makes a fire and he cooks his food, and then with the rest of it he makes an idol and bows down to worship, and you go, what's going on here? What we'll do is Mickey will take up next week with actually getting into the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation. All right. Thank you for your participation.